Begin after six taps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Greetings, and thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host and harbinger of doom, Lady P, no relation to Master P. Our first guest, when she's not busy forming a welcoming party to greet our new alien overlords, somehow finds time to make all the pretty pictures on our website. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome back to the show FlixWise's resident artist, Miss Emma Gerard.
Hello, and hail ants.
Also joining us is a man willing to make the ultimate sacrifice to save us all. It's grizzled veteran, Mr. Martin Kessler.
A very somber hello to you.
On today's show, it's the end of the world. No, we're not talking about the Republican primaries.
Oh, see what I did there? A little political humor.
Oh, but actually today's End of Days is just the movie version, though there may be some anti-capitalist sentiment expressed, so if that crack about the primaries offended you, you might want to brace yourself. Anyway, Merton is here to tell us why he thinks August Blum's 1916 disaster flick, The End of the World, is worthy of the FlixWise favorites list. Before we get started, I just want to quickly point out that this is our first silent film submission for the favorites list, and I couldn't be happier to be breaking that barrier. Now, I know this movie came out about 100 years ago, probably exactly 100 years ago, but I'm going to go out on a limb and say that perhaps a few of our listeners haven't seen the film yet. So be warned, we do intend to discuss some major plot points, but that being said, we will try to be mindful about spoiler warnings, right? Maybe?
Sure.
Maybe. Yeah. All right. Anyway, without further ado, Martin, tell us why we should embrace the end of the world.
Okay. Well, the film starts off simply enough. You have two sisters in a small mining town. You have Edith, the younger sister, who has a crush on her childhood friend, Ramirez, who's, I guess, first mate in the Navy or on a ship. And you have Dina, the elder sister, who breaks off her engagement to a young miner, Flint, and runs off with Stoll. Like, that all sounds like pretty standard melodrama stuff. But then things get drastically more complicated after Stoll's cousin, an astronomer, discovers a comet heading right towards the Earth. This leads to manipulation of the media, the stock market, class warfare, religious fervor, and it climaxes in a disaster sequence that would make Roland Emmerich drool. Mm-hmm. So I think August Blum's dark spectacle is an enduring and influential 100-year-old snapshot of the fears and anxieties of the near future that I think is worthy for the FlixWise favorites list.
All right.
That's about it, right? That's the movie
in a nutshell. Yeah, I'd say so. Emma, do you like The End of the World?
I liked it.
Yeah.
You liked it?
Yeah, I liked it. I don't know if I had super strong feelings one way or another, to be honest. Like, it didn't elicit a super strong response. But I did watch it in my living room, which is never the ideal way to watch a silent film. But that being said, it is like a wonderful snapshot of the time. But why this film as opposed to one of Blum's other films?
Oh, well, I think it's worth contextualizing this a little bit by just saying, like, this is an early silent feature film. Like, a lot of the silent films that we're used to watching came pretty late in the period. And I think they're sort of maybe aesthetically or stylistically more developed. You know, you have... Like, City Lights is, like, 1931, and, like, a lot of the ones on the Sight and Sound list, they're, like, late 20s.
Yeah.
I think Passion of Joan of Arc, that's, like, 28. So there's a lot of techniques that hadn't really developed yet. So I think, like, even by silent film standards, it might seem a little bit crude. But I think when you look at the other films being made around this time, this one's really a standout to me. I think it's... What impresses me the most is it feels like a movie. It doesn't just feel like some historical artifact. I think, like, sometimes when you watch these very early silent films, like, not only the technique of the film can feel crude, but also just the storytelling, or, like, a lot of them kind of feel like filmed plays that are silent. Mm-hmm. You know, this one, I think, especially when you take into account when it was made, it feels just exciting and engaging. Like, it's one of Blum's bigger hits. The other one that's actually a little bit bigger is Atlantis, which the big set piece is like a sinking ship, mm-hmm. a little bit like the Titanic. Mm-hmm. That's also like a little bit, I think, a more difficult film to get into compared to this. Like, I had a harder time sort of
Longer.
It's longer, and it's sort of weirder. Like, I think in The End of the World, there's a lot of scenes where I sort of felt like, oh, I've seen this before. I've seen other films sort of doing a modern version of the same scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think that's one thing that helped me really click with this one, as opposed to maybe one of his other films.
Yeah.
Huh. I wonder what it would have been like to be in the audience when you saw this, because, like, there weren't a lot of, like, genres to rely on in this, in 1916, and even still, it seems like it's a pretty, like you said, it's a pretty standard melodrama until this disaster hits, and it's like the entire expectation of everything that's going to happen in the movie changes.
Yeah.
And then it's like all this weird kind of like political commentary and like speculation.
Yeah.
I feel like that would even be a weird movie to watch now.
Yeah.
And we would be, if it came out now, we'd be like going like, oh, well, how are they marketing it like in America versus England? Like, oh, it turns out there's zombies. Like, yeah. Or are we going to go into the movie not knowing there's zombies? Like, it's like that kind of movie.
Totally. Okay. Yeah. Well, the title, it's kind of, it sets you up for a big disaster, and then you got to wait about an hour before anything actually happened, which is kind of hilarious. And effective, mm-hmm. you know, there will be blood. Eventually, there's blood. But, like, it's kind of about anticipating disaster rather than the disaster. And then the actual payoff of the movie is really impressive.
I think, too, like, the whole idea of the comet destroying the world that had been sort of in the public consciousness sense that there was a big comet panic in 1910 when Halley's Comet, I guess Earth passed through its tail, and a lot of people thought, like, oh, we're all going to die. I think the film is sort of dangling something that was had a popular appeal, seeing the world destroyed by a comet, and used people being invested in that to kind of sneak in all this other stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about all the other stuff. What was happening in 1916? What, pray tell? Was there something happening in Europe?
Isn't, like, it's weird to think that this is before the Bolshevik Revolution. This is before the stock market crash. This, I think it's actually kind of prophetic. I think, mm-hmm. like, a lot of this stuff was obviously just in the air at the time. I think probably people were anxious or nervous or afraid that some of these things were going to come to mm-hmm. fruition, and they did, so.
Yeah, well, I mean, could, there were, they're in the middle of a war, right?
Yeah, this is a war period film, yeah.
Yeah, so is the comet a representation of just, it's just looming destruction? Like, there is no, it doesn't, the comet is apolitical, it's just a big, big rock coming to destroy the Earth. But it, well, I don't want to give away the ending. we'll get to it. We'll give you a fair spoiler warning. But at a certain point,
spoiler alert, the world ends.
The world ends. I don't want to give anything away. It's kind of in the title. the film is obviously not apolitical. It's taking a stance, but it's not saying this side is wrong and this side is right. It's more like we're all wrong, and there are certain people who are willing to exploit this disaster and they will profit from it. Mm-hmm. But yeah,
that's kind of extraordinary about this movie too. Like, it's like talking about like disaster capitalism in this like pretty apolitical, abstract way, and it's like, I don't think that's like a term even coined until like after like 9/11.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Disaster capitalism. Yeah. Yeah. It's true. That message could have come out post 9/11, but it would never get away with it. And this was in the middle of the war. People are talking about this. I guess there were a few movies after the Iraq War started where they talked about buying and selling of weapons. Mm-hmm. I do believe that came out. Although, and like Iron Man kind of addresses that a little bit too. So that is like a mainstream film. It doesn't address it in any kind of sophisticated way.
Yeah.
But I think people were probably more open to hearing those sorts of things back then,
before
if I had
the roaring 20s.
Yeah. things were, like when we talk about, like, at least in the United States, when we talk about like robber barons, like there were plenty of depictions of our big capitalist people that were less than flattering. Like, I don't think you could get away with depicting them as anything else. And film is such a populist medium.
But I mean, the people that rise up against him aren't necessarily depicted as being like super heroic either. I think
that's
it's more
true.
Like a consequence of this. It's one thing leads to another. It's less like it's sort of shown
right.
as being reactionary and kind of really ugly. Like the sequence where they're breaking down the doors and shooting people, like, it's pretty horrific, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. It's not like Frank Capra populism.
Right.
Nothing wrong with that. but yeah, it's interesting. But what the people that do come out looking heroic are kind of the religious types.
Yeah. I always get like a bad vibe from the priest in this film because I think partly it's like hard to watch this out without thinking of like that Heaven's Gate cult, and I always get like a bad vibe from him, and then like at the end he kind of turns into a heroic figure. And
well, also, if we can talk about the end, spoil that.
Spoilers. All right, here we go. We're gonna talk about the ending.
There's a pretty strong Christian bent to the end too.
Yes, like, indeed. Now, Martin.
Yep.
I don't want you to get the impression that just because it ends in bells means it automatically is one of the greatest movies of all time.
No, but I kind of kept, like, I'm glad we can talk about this film on the podcast because I kept wanting to bring it up during the show, and I sort of felt like I would be, like, willfully obscure if I was like, it reminds me of this 1916 movie with Adolphe, like, talking about Satan Tango and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Like, but I think, like, maybe there is something foundational in this film. Like, this was a very popular film at its time, and it influenced a lot of filmmakers. It was very widely seen. Like, probably one of the people that you can draw a very easy connection to is Carl Dreyer, who actually worked for Blum at this time. I think he wrote for Blum's films. He was very much inspired by him. And I think, like, if you look at sort of, especially in that final sequence, the younger sister wandering through the destruction, and like a lot of the images, those like very stark kind of images that are also beautiful, remind me of Dreyer especially. And that's like the type of religious ending you might expect from Carl Dreyer.
Yes.
And I think you can draw like lineage of Danish cinema that goes from August Blum through Dreyer all the way up to guys like Lars von Trier and Nick Reffin. I think like there is something sort of consistent in the themes and tone in some of the visuals of maybe Danish cinema, I think, anyway.
Well, when you initially suggested this, you mentioned that this might serve as a replacement on the Sight and Sound list to something like Melancholia, which...
I mean, Melancholia is like halfway to being a remake of this. I mean, like, it has a very sort of different purpose and point of view, but it's also just a film about two sisters, and it starts off like a melodrama, and it doesn't really get into this... cosmic destruction until halfway through, and it also has, I think, that like mounting anxiety and tension of just like seeing this thing in the sky getting bigger and bigger and you can't stop it, and like I couldn't find anything exactly, but I would be shocked if Lars von Trier hadn't seen this film.
Can you maybe contextualize this? Like, what other notable films would have been coming out at the time?
Mostly single reel still. Like, the other filmmaker from this time that was working that you could probably compare him to is D.W. Griffith.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Whose films are still, I guess, considered relevant. I mean, if there's one technical thing I think D.W. Griffith had over Blum, I think it's the use of close-up. Like, this end of the world really could have benefited, I think, from close-ups, because it's such an expressive technique. And there's so many scenes in the film that like you see sort of the roots of more expressive filmmaking, like when he's going down into the mines and you have like the shadows or you know, the very like silhouette type shots that are backlit by the sun's reflection on the water. Like, I think close-up technique would have fit really, really well into this film, and I think it just didn't occur to him because it wasn't widely used at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And like that's one thing that I think Dreyer definitely utilized.
Yeah, he definitely did. Yeah.
It's all in close up, some of them.
Yes. yeah, but I think that's a great point of reference. Obviously, Blum is not as frequently cited, or maybe just not here in the States, but that's amazing that around... When did Birth of a Nation come out?
1915.
Okay. 1915.
I mean, some people even... it's really hard to find exact information, but a lot of people were speculating that D.W. Griffith might have been inspired by watching Blum's multi-reel films like Atlantis and some of the early Italian feature films in making Birth of a Nation, but it's hard to say for sure.
Yeah.
You know, who knows who saw what or how widely some of these films were seen.
Yeah. To be honest, Atlantis is kind of, it's amazing.
It's amazing.
And, well, I mean, they're both amazing. I do think you're right that that The End of the World is more coherent. but the, just the staging of the ship sinking is amazing. You could see its influence on every other ship sinking movie that has come out since.
There's a quote from Blum's obituary that was on Wikipedia that said, he knew he wasn't some directorial genius, but he proved that he was the cleverest and most tasteful scene creator of his day. And I think maybe that's kind of true. Like, I don't think he was a great technical innovator. Mm-hmm. He was just making good films.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Like, I wouldn't want the films of today that are canonized necessarily being the ones that are the most technically innovative, because they're not always the best.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, so I think, like, it's worth maybe digging into just, like, not only which films were advancing the media of film, but which ones were sort of good and popular as well.
I think, I'd like both to be considered.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, in some ways, Blum's films qualify on both fronts. I mean, it's just, like, at the time, you know, Birth of a Nation endures because... I don't know. Again, it could just be because I'm an American, and like that has such an important place in not only film history but also American history.
But I find this like infinitely more easy to watch than Birth of a Nation. Like, I mean, tangential to the racism, there are things that make Birth of a Nation very difficult to sit through.
I completely agree. It's super fragmented.
Like, one thing that's great about this film is just like the pacing. Like, it's not like one scene after another. You see how these scenes sort of build into each other, and I think like a sequence like one of my favorite sequences is the comet dance during the End of the World party.
Yes.
And like you see that intercut with shots of destruction, and like you see that technique really used today. You know, you have a again, like mostly in popular films, you'll watch something like Fifth Element where you have an opera scene cut with shooting and action or stuff like that, but it's really effective. And I think like there's a rhythm to this film that I don't know if D.W. Griffith's films had necessarily, at least at that time.
Yeah, sir. I don't think Birth of a Nation does. I'd say like Broken Blossoms, kind of, but...
Yeah. Sure, or I mean, even Intolerance, I think...
I've actually never seen Intolerance, so I couldn't say if that...
I've seen at least the first 20 minutes.
Yeah.
At first I thought like people just put Intolerance on the Sight and Sound list because they didn't want to put the D.W. Griffith film that's like notoriously racist.
Yeah.
But like, it's good though.
Okay, that's good to know. I will watch it eventually, obviously. But yeah.
Oh, another, I feel like, achievement of this film is it figured out that like an hour and 20 minutes is like exactly as long as you need to tell this kind of story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's that's the thing about Atlantis and why, like, a part of me says, like, Atlantis is from 1913, so it's earlier, and it feels kind of almost more ambitious, but it's also...
It's definitely more ambitious, I would say.
Yeah, but it's also not as cohesive. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Do we give it points for ambition? Maybe. I think people should see both, to be honest.
Yeah, I would recommend them both.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes those older silent films, too, I feel more like you're watching, like, performance art. Like, it's more about the costuming and the staging. Yeah. Like, I could sit through Atlantis for even longer because it's just, like, so pretty and
cool. It is true, yeah. That's true. I did love the costumes in Atlantis. I love the way it looked. So, like, the costumes in The End of the World are not as impressive.
No, but no. The story makes sense.
The story actually makes sense. So points for that. but yeah, back to the party scene. I was telling Emma before we started recording that it actually reminded me of Rules of the Game. Which...
it's not a good sign on this podcast.
Which, no, I think it reminded me of Rules of the Game. Well, that was my favorite sequence in Rules of the Game with the dancing skeletons.
Right.
But there's this sense, like, when you stick a dancing scene, it's like, in a movie about disaster, it's like they're doing a dance of death. And, like, there's imminent destruction, and here they are dancing the night away.
I forget what the exact title card is, but it's something like, as if to mock fate, he threw a party.
Yeah. Good step. But maybe this should go instead of Rules of the Game. I won't do it. I'm not... the reason that we always bring up Rules of the Game is because I feel like it is our shortcoming that we don't adore Rules of the Game. And so it is just us trying to reconcile that. Right?
We've set up this elaborate thing where you have to keep listening to the podcast in order to find out what we really thought about Rules of the Game.
Exactly. This is a long con. Eventually... I predict by the time we're done with this podcast, the Rules of the Game will be number one on our list, on our personal list.
Not to dwell on it, but also I think in early films, there's always like this transition from, well, not even in early films, they still do this, but like in the transition from like stage to cinema, that there's this need to have this musical interlude to kind of break things up. So I think that you see that commonly. Whereas Rules of the Game does this other thing where you're going backstage, so it's kind of a different phenomenon.
It's true. It's true. But same kind of effect where, like, disaster looms. But, and, like, you don't even really... see much disaster in the Rules of the Game. This is going to turn into a Rules of the Game podcast. I didn't mean for that to happen. But back to the comparison with Melancholia and just kind of the history of Danish cinema. I don't know if we necessarily think of the Danish as being huge pioneers in the cinematic evolution.
You don't think so? I mean, like, I think they have one of the best film traditions of... or one of the oldest and best of most countries. I mean, America, of course, has the best, but...
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think of... maybe it's just because they're not... The films aren't as popular here, but I think you're right in that it's that clearly, like, would the... I've read on the internet that the early 1910s were considered the golden age of Danish cinema, right? Mm-hmm. At a certain point, we cannot implement our own aesthetic preferences on the movies from the 1910s. Like, it becomes irrelevant. It's just, like, everything you do is fascinating.
And, like, a lot of the aesthetics we think of from silent era, like, didn't exist. Like, there was no German expressionism.
Right, yeah.
So it's...
Yeah. That was all after the war.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's so crazy. When I think of the war, I think of the Great War. I think of the literature and artwork that comes afterwards. But this, this was during the war. This is something that was directly addressing the things that were happening at the time, albeit through allegory. But it's not even subtle, which is kind of amazing.
No, like the comet pieces bearing down on the city. Like, you can imagine... seeing, like, an artillery strike. Like, I think if somebody just spliced those scenes into, like, you know, newsreel footage of World War I, you wouldn't necessarily notice that it wasn't, you know, real footage.
Totally, yeah. Absolutely. And they say, you know, movies about war don't play well during wartime, so you have to kind of wrap it up in some other genre.
So this, I guess, is kind of a, it's a disaster film. So it's sort of setting that precedent. But were there other, I believe there were other, would this be considered one of the first disaster movies or just like the first kind of feature length multi-reel disaster movie?
I think it's like maybe the first one that I'd say like sort of sets a lot of those genre tropes up. They're like shorter films, one reel films that'll show like a scene of disaster, but that's all it really is. This one, like, you know, for instance, the scene where they're talking about, well, we shouldn't tell the public that the comet's going to hit because that might cause panic. And then it gets like leaked out. Like, I've seen that, I think, a million times. And that's something that we think of as being sort of integral to disaster films. You know, like I've seen that exact same scene in Deep Impact.
Yeah. How does it hold up against Deep Impact? In your professional opinion.
How do you answer?
I know. Like that? Obviously, they're both equally great. what was happening? I know we've had this discussion, like it's come up before, where in the late 90s, even mid 90s, like we were just all about destroying the world, whether it be aliens or comets.
And it seems like some of them are making kind of a comeback now.
It's true. 2012 and...
Yeah, 2012. It's like, let's throw in all the disasters. Yeah,
San Andreas, Los Angeles is falling into the ocean. There's a new... Yeah.
Independence Day film coming out.
Oh my God, yeah.
Oh my God, really? There's some big Scandinavian disaster movie coming out, too. Oh, okay. I saw a trailer for.
There's still...
It's about a tsunami or something.
Oh boy.
Fjord falling into the ocean.
Oh, yeah. I don't know. And then like we're starting to like find humor in the end of the world. Like there's that NBC that show You, Me, and the Apocalypse. I don't know what's going. Yeah. Like we're all feeling very pessimistic right now.
That's different from disaster movies are different than post-apocalypse That's fantasies.
True. Though. That's true. But this is like
we
looming.
Definitely like post-apocalypse. Well,
that is so, for sure. But yeah. No, this one is looming apocalypse. Like I think a comet is gonna hit the Earth.
It could.
Yeah, well, in the show.
Oh.
I mean, there's something about, like, having those anxieties realized on film that I think is very cathartic. Like, we feel anxious, and then by seeing it happen, it sort of relieves some of those tensions, maybe.
Yeah.
Like, it feels good watching stuff blow up, even though, like, it might be what we're sort of afraid of happening. Yeah. Maybe. Yeah. I mean, this does kind of go into post-apocalyptic territory in that final sequence. It feels very much like a post-apocalyptic... I guess it is. Post-apocalyptic, yeah. Truly.
The first post-apocalyptic film. The first disaster movie and the first post-apocalyptic film.
A lot of disaster movies, too, though, you get the sense that they're kind of delighting in destroying the things that they destroy, like in Independence Day.
Yeah.
It's like all these like kind of ugly buildings that nobody likes.
Yeah, that White House.
Oh, I was thinking more of like that like bank building downtown or like...
it's true.
I mean, this is blowing up like all the mines and all the industry. I think like, again, there's maybe something political in that. Seeing like an industrious mining town just get blown apart.
Yeah. I think like there's probably a sense with the Industrial Revolution. I'm sure there was a sense like, can't we just go back to the way things were? Sort of romantic idea that, you know, maybe we can just all start over. I don't know. But comet is probably not the way to do that. You're going to have some trouble farming after a comet hits. If we ask the dinosaurs. Anyway. But yeah, I was Martin, I was honestly hoping you would throw a little more shade towards Melancholia, but whatever.
Okay. Well, I mean, I like Melancholia, I was surprised that it made it on the Sight and Sound list.
Yeah.
I think it's just one of those things that, like, for some reason, because it was new at the time that they were doing the poll, like, it's... You know, it's almost like when they try and get movies right out before Oscar voting season. Yeah. It's like, you just watched it and it's fresh in your mind. So it's like, oh, this is one of the greatest films I've ever seen. And like, carry that to the polls. Yeah. Maybe. I get anxious very easily. So like Melancholy, everyone was talking about, oh yeah, it's allegory for depression and Kirsten Dunst's character's depressed. And like, I related much more to the Charlotte Gainsbourg character because she's just anxious and fretting. And I feel like I would be doing all the same things that she does. And like that sort of panic that she experiences, like, I think I almost threw up in the theater watching. I saw it like in the front row watching Melancholia. So it was like traumatic experience. And this wasn't quite that, but like, still like watching End of the World at like 2 a.m. and seeing that comet kind of hovering in the air and feeling the tension build, like it makes me a little anxious or nervous. I think it's actually, you know, there's still a potency to the images.
Yeah, I think, yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know why there is a lot of potency to the images. It's just for whatever reason, it's hard for me to say this absolutely deserves to be on the list. But I think you've made a very compelling argument, Martin. I don't know. But yeah, because I do think I would like to, like, it is important to acknowledge film history. And as you say, it still holds up really well, probably, you know, better than Birth of a Nation. So,
I mean, it takes a lot of context, I think, to sort of watch this film.
Yeah.
But far less context than it takes to watch many of its contemporaries.
Yeah.
So, like, maybe on those grounds.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I think, like, even on the Sight and Sound list, like, the only thing older than Intolerance is maybe Trip to the Moon, I think, might be on there. And that's, I think, from, like, a little bit before. But again, that's one real... Yeah. Méliès, like one thing again in contrast to Méliès, like I like that this is trying to present you with serious images. Like the special effects are genuinely trying to make you feel like this is happening, mm-hmm. as opposed to a Trip to the Moon, where it's very sort of fantastic and stylized, right. And you're sort of taking some splendor in just like the strangeness or unreality, mm-hmm. of it. I think this is like got a sort of a different, stark, serious Northern European, yeah. beauty to it. Like I was even reading, I found a piece of criticism of Auguste Blum where it's like, oh, he's not a good filmmaker, he doesn't know how to expose properly, mm-hmm. and I think they were referring specifically probably to those types of shots where it's like a total silhouette. But I think those are some of the most beautiful shots in the film. They're like gorgeous, yeah. I think.
When he's silhouetted against the sea.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think you're right. That's very expressive, evocative shots.
I think it's true that on one hand you could say, well, he was commercial filmmaker exploiting subject matter of his day to make films the way, you know, maybe a Michael Bay today does. But I think like there's a lot of genuine artistry, maturity, intelligence in his work. So I think like maybe even if this film isn't worthy of a FlixWise favorites list, at least like I would hope people, you know, might acknowledge his work, yeah. and maybe check some of it out. You know, I think like maybe if you combined The Forces of Atlantis and The End of the World and a few of his other films, I think it might be enough for people to sort of regard him as one of the first great filmmakers.
Yeah. I think I buy that argument. How about you, Emma?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think you've sold us, Mark. I sincerely hope people do check that out. I mean, I think the context is extremely helpful in determining whether or not this film is worthy. Like, if not this film, then his cumulative body of work is certainly worthy of just acknowledging and, I would say, canonizing. Like, it's, you know, as we say, the Danes have a long legacy of churning out some really great, important filmmakers, and this guy's kind of the father, the grandfather of them all. So I think he is as important. It's as important to acknowledge him as any of the other forebearers of cinema. So, I you know, yay, Martin. I think this is truly a victory for you, really.
Better than I expected.
So, honestly, just check it out. It's on YouTube. Got no excuse. And that's the way we frame it, FlixWise, that is. Listeners, have you seen The End of the World? Does it go out with a bang or a whimper? Come tell us on our website, FlixWise.com. Or you can like us and leave us a comment on our Facebook page at Facebook.com/FlixWise. And we can all gather together and wait for the end on Twitter. The handle is @FlixWise. But before you do all of that, please help us get in good with the robot despots by rating us and leaving us a comment on iTunes or Stitcher or whatever your podcatcher of choice is. Next week's Sight and Sound entry is another Danish classic. It's Carl Theodor Dreyer's Gertrude. Until then, Martin, thank you so much for bringing the end of the world to our attention.
I'm glad you heard the bad news.
Emma, thank you as always.
Thanks. I'm going to go watch August Blom's anti-Mormon movie now on YouTube.
Is that available?
Yes.
Nice. Oh, goodness. Filmmakers hating Mormons since 1916. But, all right. We're off to our secret underground lair until we meet again. I'm going to go ahead and suggest hunkering down.